from the White House, and who control is the controlling shareholder of Freeport-McMoRan, the oil and the mining giant of copper and gold, which has been ravaging West Papua, taking their gold and copper, but which, and this is quite significant, recently has been under challenge from the Jokowi government. For years, Freeport-McMoRan has had a free ride in Indonesia. As long as they paid off General Suharto and his cronies, as long as they paid off the army, various bureaucrats, they were able to do whatever they want. They were able to just strip the mountains of West Papua, turn the rivers indescribable primary colors from their pollution, knock off their dissident workers when necessary. They were able to do anything. But now, just in the past year and a half or so, they have been under challenge from the Jokowi government, which is demanding a renegotiation of the contract between the Indonesian government and Freeport-McMoRan, and which has been restricting Freeport's copper exports. So this is creating a problem for ICON, a serious economic problem for Carl ICON. As this conflict between the Jokowi government and ICON's Freeport has been going on, the local lawyer for ICON's Freeport has been helping to lead the coup movement to oust Jokowi. Now, I don't know how much Trump knows about this, but I know there's some question among some officials in Indonesia as to, in the end, which side will the U.S. come down on? Will it continue the traditional U.S. policy of wanting to keep an elected president in for kind of stability purposes and front purposes? Or might it align with Trump's personal and business connections on the other side who were backing the coup?
Investigative journalist Alan Nairn will link to his piece at The Intercept. Tune in tomorrow for our coverage on the March on Washington, of March for Science in Washington. And on Sunday, I'll be speaking at Princeton University. Special thanks to Sam Alkoff and Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 5:01. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of La Inaugurada La Primavera on April 21st and 22nd. Two nights of joy and justice in a multi-venue call to action in response to the immigration ban. On April 21st, La Inaugurada La Primavera features Alex and Allison Gray, Las Cafeteras, and Gran Ritmos, at Navasquez, and Voz Workers' Rights Education Project at the Melody Ballroom. April 22nd at the Crystal Ballroom will feature Alex and Allison Gray, Daca Braca, Future Primitive, The Human Experience, and Orquesta Pacifico Tropical. Again, that's La Inaugurada La Primavera on April 21st and 22nd, two nights of joy and justice in a multi-venue call to action in response to the immigration ban. Venue addresses and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Governor Kate Brown has signed a hiring freeze for government employees.
14 Oregon towns will join the Global March for Science on Saturday.
The United States Treasury Department has refused Exxon's request for a waiver to drill for oil in Russia.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 21st, 2017, the 91st day of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Jasmine. On Thursday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed a two-month hiring freeze for state employees. The announcement came as part of a continuing effort to address the state's anticipated $1.6 billion budget shortfall over the next biennial. The order goes into effect on May 1st and runs through June 30th, unless extended by the governor. In addition to the hiring freeze, the order also directs state agencies to look for opportunities to reduce leasing costs and requires state agencies to reduce travel expenses by at least 10%. The executive order does not affect services that are, quote, critical to life, health, or public safety, or that generate revenue, end quote. The governor's order came after Republicans in the legislature called on the governor to impose an indefinite freeze, which they claimed could save as much as $790 million over the next 2 years. In their statement, Brown asked all elected officials to take a close look at their operations and look for ways to save. But she recognized that savings alone will not close the gap and indicated that there will be additional executive orders designed to save money. Possibilities include changes to public pension system funding, renegotiation of contracts with suppliers to the state, and changes in the way the state bargains with employee unions.
The state of Oregon is not the only one with a budget problem. The city of Portland is looking at a potential $4 million budget shortfall over the next 5 years. In January, Mayor Ted Wheeler asked bureau chiefs to find ways to cut their expenses by 5% to close the gap. For the city's Parks and Recreation Bureau, that equates to a $3.2 million cut to next year's budget. The Bureau proposed 18 areas for budget reduction, including fee increases, the shutdown of city fountains, and postponement of maintenance projects. Included on the list is the discontinuation of a popular, educational preschool program that serves 600 children at a number of sites around the city. Despite public feedback that showed strong support, proponents are concerned that the $687,000 program may not survive. Mayor Wheeler will release his proposed budget on May 1st. The City Council is scheduled to hold public hearings on May 11th and to make a budget decision on May 17th.
Scientists and climate activists opposed to the Trump administration will be taking to the streets of Washington on Saturday in the March for Science. Organizers say that the march is intended to protest the administration's policies on climate change and other issues. Using the Women's March as a model, event organizers hope that a strong turnout will demonstrate national support for strong commitment to science. Speakers include former administration officials, musicians, and science activists led by Bill Nye the Science Guy. Nye, a popular educator and television personality, is serving as the honorary co-chair for Saturday's march. The event's Twitter account has over 350,000 followers, and the Facebook page has over 500,000 likes. And with 393 marches happening worldwide, Nye is hoping that mass demonstrations will show lawmakers around the world how much people care about science. 14 of those marches are scheduled for towns big and small in Oregon. Eric Tegedoff of Oregon News Service has more.
Marchers in cities big and small across the nation this Saturday say the evidence is clear. It's time to stand up for science. Although organizers of the March for Science are trying to steer the marches away from politics, many in the scientific community are concerned about the new administration's denial of evidence for man-made climate change and its silencing of federal scientists and national park employees. The main march will be in Washington, D.C., but many smaller sister marches will be going on in Oregon. Andrea Mann is helping organize a march in Pendleton.
Well, we find it's important to talk about science and let people know how much science touches everybody's lives and how important it is to have fact-based science.
At least 14 sister marches are planned across the state in major cities, as well as smaller cities like St. Helens, Klamath Falls, Coos Bay, and more. Many will include family-friendly activities such as science fairs to promote the importance of science. The march also coincides with Earth Day. Mann says Pendleton has become more politically active after a large turnout for the Women's March in January. After that, organizers decided to focus their efforts on this march. However, Mann, who used to work for the USDA, says a lot of researchers and scientists who work for the federal government locally don't feel as if they can risk attending the march.
a lot of them have been given the gag order. They can't talk about climate change and science. They want to be there for the march, but their employers may not allow them to.
The National March for Science website also denies the march is political. It notes a nationwide trend toward discrediting scientific consensus and asks, can we afford not to speak out in science's defense? For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Hear the phrase green walls, and you might think perhaps the southern border wall proposed by the Trump administration is taking on an eco-friendly theme. But the green walls going up in Seattle's South Park are being built to clean the air and reduce air pollution. A project of the Duwamish Community Action for Clean Air Project, the first set of green walls were put up on the grounds of the South Park Public Library. The local merchants association says they're ready to help build more, and talks are underway with the Port of Seattle for a bigger project. FSRN's Martha Baskin has the story.
Beneath handcrafted green wall panels on the site of a public library, youth in Seattle's South Park immigrant community plant honeysuckle, jasmine, and clematis. Soon their leafy vines will climb metal cables welded onto the panels. When fully grown, the green walls will filter particulates and help clean the air in a neighborhood dominated by highways, air traffic, and industry.
We're doing a green wall because in South Park we think that there's a lot of pollution.
Hooden Meyer is a local high school student. Asthma rates for young people here are double compared to the rest of Seattle. Life expectancy is also 13 years lower. So the community came together to find solutions. Planting trees was the first solution. Trees are carbon storage experts. 700 have been planted over the last year and a half. The second was to build green walls. Paulina Lopez is an organizer with the Duwamish Community Action for Clean Air, which launched the Green Wall Project. Lopez refers to community members learning about the walls for the first time.
When we have been telling them about the walls, they just hear the walls and then they are like thinking, what are you talking about? And they have been saying, these are the only walls that we want. We need more green walls.
The South Park Merchant Association has agreed to build more green walls, and talks are underway with the Port of Seattle, whose trucks run through the neighborhood for a bigger project. The historically industrial neighborhood of South Park has long dealt with environmental hazards never fully remedied, including a river, the Duwamish, filled with legacy toxins and storm runoff, Puget Sound's most persistent clean water challenge. But after a report highlighted the area's cumulative health impacts, air quality became a priority. Lynn Gould with Just Health Action authored the report and was on hand to help with planting the first green wall.
You can work on air quality upstream, you know, by like changing emission standards, but how do you work on air quality from the community where they have this opportunity to take action? But you put green walls where you can't put trees. You know, you put them in places that are unique where other things can't happen.
A clinical instructor at the University of Washington School of Public Health, Gould says a key ingredient to improving health is self-confidence and social cohesion.
When you think you can do something together, it actually improves your health. And so here are these kids, they see what they can do for the community and they want to do it elsewhere. They want to make a difference.
The youth are done planting. Now, high schooler Hodan Meyer and her friend Natividad tie the vines of a honeysuckle around the slender cables of the handcrafted green wall panels.
Yeah, we're tying it around so they don't fall, because if they fall, they're not going to be able to grow like we want them to grow.
Green Wall project manager Andrew Schiffer says the concept was to merge public art with public good. Artists and welders donated their time. The site chosen for installation of the community's first green wall, a public library across from a highway, already had a depiction of the Duwamish River on the ground.
So we wanted to add into that and become part of that.
Schiffer points to raindrops suspended from metal cables.
So we have the raindrops falling down on the metal cutout panels, and then the plants help the water to evapotranspirate to go back up and evaporate.
The installation of 7 green wall panels may seem symbolic, but a granular approach is what it takes to integrate green-growing things into existing hardscapes, says Sean Watts with the Seattle Parks Foundation.
This kind of amenity needs to be core to creating the livable city that we want to see in the future.
For South Park, The future is now. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for the rain to return with temperatures in the low 60s. East of the Cascades in Hood River, you can look forward to a partly cloudy day and a high of about 65. Today, in 1956, Elvis Presley achieved his first number one hit with Heartbreak Hotel. According to Billboard magazine, Presley had 18 songs go to the top of the Billboard Top 100 list during his career. The quote of the day is from John Lennon, who said, quote, "Nothing really affected me until I heard Elvis. If there hadn't been an Elvis, there wouldn't have been a Beatles," end quote.
Throughout the campaign and since his inauguration, Donald Trump has promised to expel undocumented immigrants and tighten borders to prevent Muslims and anyone else that he deems undesirable from entering the United States. He's also constantly reminded us of his supposed business genius and promised to bring back jobs while making America great again. In tonight's commentary, KBOO's Ray Bodwell looks at the actual damage that Trump's xenophobia is beginning to do to the U.S. economy.
By any measure, travel and tourism is a huge business in the United States. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the industry directly accounted for $1.6 trillion in economic output in 2015 and accounted for over 7.5 million jobs. The U.S. Travel Association puts the number at $2.3 trillion and over 15 million jobs if you include both direct and indirect spending with travel. The association says the workers in travel and tourism earn $248 billion in wages and that travel generates $158 billion in tax revenues at the federal, state, and local level. But like Blanche DuBois, the travel and tourism industry in large part depends on the kindness of strangers. And with more than 76 million international tourists visiting the U.S. last year, you'd think that Trump would exercise some caution when making public statements that might harm an industry that is the sixth largest employer in the U.S. But no, if he's not bad-mouthing Mexicans as rapists and drug dealers, he's complaining that Europeans don't pay their fair share for NATO or refusing to shake German Chancellor Angela Merkel's hand. He's angered the French with his comments on terrorism and refused to apologize to arguably our closest allies after making baseless accusations that the British Intelligence Service spied on behalf of his predecessor. He's threatened Japan with punitive tariffs for building cars in Mexico and called China a currency manipulator on his first day in office. He referred to his phone call with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull as, quote, "the worst ever," end quote, and enraged South Koreans by referring to Korea as a historical part of China. Yesterday, he attacked Canada for continuing to deploy protective tariffs around its dairy industry. Trump's attack came despite the fact that Canada imports $400 million more in dairy products from the U.S. than it exports. These are just a few of the insults that he's leveled at 9 out of the top 10 countries whose citizens annually visit the U.S. The only one he missed is Brazil, and it's probably because he doesn't know where it is. Unfortunately, it appears that our international friends have been paying attention and decided that America isn't such a welcoming place anymore. In early March, Tamara Jacoby, the CEO of Immigration Works USA, had this to say on CGTN America.
This isn't just a reaction to the specifics of the order. This isn't really just about refugees. This is about foreigners in general feeling, wait, the door is closing. These people don't like foreigners, don't want foreigners.
And on Monday, CNBC financial reporter Susan Lee had this.
But the two executive orders signed by the president, which were subsequently blocked by district courts, have already sent the message to global travelers to maybe look elsewhere. Bookings to the U.S. are down in virtually every market, according to booking app Hopper. Tourism Economics predicts 4.3 million fewer tourists to the U.S., which translates to over $7 billion in lost revenue this year.
But perhaps most telling, on Wednesday, Dubai-based Emirates Airlines, the number one rated airline for customer satisfaction, according to Business Insider, announced a significant cutback in service to the U.S. In a statement, the airline said, quote, "Over the past 3 months, we have seen a significant deterioration in the booking profiles on all our U.S. routes across all travel segments. Emirates has therefore responded, as any profit-oriented enterprise would, and we will redeploy capacity to serve demand on other routes on our global network," end quote. Donald Trump may fancy himself a brilliant businessman, but the mindless rants of the dealmaker-in-chief has managed to throw cold water on a segment of the U.S. economy that provides one out of every nine American jobs. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Longtime political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal has a major court date this Monday. It's also his birthday. The petition that will be heard on Monday seeks to overturn all of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decisions against him, based on a claim of judicial bias by Justice Ronald Castile. Lawyers for Mumia, think they have a pretty good case based on the precedent of Terry Williams, whose case was heard before the same judge, Ronald Castile. Williams' case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where his claim of judicial bias by Castile was upheld. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Dr. Suzanne Ross, one of the organizers of Mumia's support team.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this petition that's going to be heard in court on Monday.
Yes. Well, first, let me say that we're on a roll right now because we just had a major victory on the issue of Mumia getting the health care that he was entitled to. You know, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, but he was deathly ill and literally nearly died 2 years ago when the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections refused to give him the medication that he needed for his hepatitis C. First, they misdiagnosed his condition, and then after we got a doctor to go in there who diagnosed it, they insisted he didn't have it, and then when they finally admitted he did have the disease, he said they were monitoring and treating him properly, and it took a judge, a federal judge, to order them to actually give him the medication. Mumia's case on the health issue opens up treatment for all the other Pennsylvania prisoners who have hepatitis C. There's 7,000, somewhere around 7,000 of them. Actually, 5 out of the 7,000 got treatment. But, you know, thousands of them obviously have not. And now they have a precedent on which they can rely in filing for their own treatment. So that is a major, major factor, because we never were only concerned about Mumia, and certainly Mumia wasn't. Now we are going into another phase, and now we're going before a judge in the Court of Common Pleas, which is the Pennsylvania court, the Philadelphia, actually, court. It's where Mumia was first convicted and sentenced to death under the notorious Judge Szabo. After the trial happened, a few years later, there was an appeal, a whole appeals process that's called the Post-Conviction Relief Act in Pennsylvania. That's what it's called. It's an appeals process that goes before the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And at that time, the head of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania was a judge named Ronald Castile, who had also been in the prosecutor's office in the city of Philadelphia when Mumia was first prosecuted and sentenced to death.
And the case is that this Castile had judicial bias against Mumia?
Well, he ruled against him and rejected every single appeal. I believe there were 33 bases for rejecting the original case and saying what was wrong with what had happened in Szabo's court. The whole world was outraged at that time by Judge Szabo, who actually said outside of the courtroom, told another judge, "I'm going to help them fry this N, use the N word, and a clerk overheard him and reported it. And the judge, who then listened to it, said, oh, that didn't show any bias in his rulings. So everything that happened in the lower courts were rubber-stamped by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, not surprisingly, since this guy had been involved in the first place in the conviction. But he wouldn't recuse himself, you know, withdraw himself for the case. Two legal attempts were made to have him recuse himself. 2 years ago, a brother named Williams, who was in the same position as Mumia, his case had been ruled over originally by Castile when he was a prosecutor, and then he came before Castile again when he was head of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And this brother took this case to court. The Supreme Court ruled that Castile should have recused himself. So Mumia's attorneys immediately filed the same thing, to negate, to make null and void all the decisions that this judge had made.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Suzanne Ross, one of the organizers of these caravans going to Philadelphia on Monday, when Mumia Abu-Jamal is having a hearing on a petition that he has filed challenging the judicial integrity of the judge involved in the Supreme Court decision against him. The information can be found if you go to freemumia.com. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
French citizens go to the polls this weekend in the first round of what many view as the most pivotal presidential election in decades. Five closely bunched candidates representing the far right, the far left, and everything in between are striving to become one of the top two finishers in the first round. Those two will face each other in a runoff election on May 7th. But even as voters prepared for Sunday's vote, an apparent terrorist attack in Paris threw another variable into an already topsy-turvy race. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
As voters in France gear up for the first round of presidential elections this weekend, a gunman opened fire on police in Paris Thursday. One officer died, two others were injured, and the gunman was shot and killed as he tried to flee the scene on the city's storied Champs-Élysées. The incident that French President François Hollande said appeared to be an act of terrorism is adding fuel to the nationalist fire that's thrust the country's far right-wing party to the top of the polls just days ahead of the vote. The election in the country, that's both a NATO partner and a permanent member of the UN Security Council, is the latest ballot box test for an international surge in right-wing nationalism, which has seen recent wins in the UK, Hungary, and Poland. And as with the 2016 US election that brought Donald Trump to power, analysts in France claim that Russia is interfering in the political process. Candidates once considered part of the extremist fringe are now riding a wave into the political mainstream and possibly into France's highest office. Before we go, we have an important announcement. After 17 years of bringing you stories from the ground from all over the world, FSRN is shutting down permanently for financial reasons. We'd like to sincerely thank all of the individuals and stations who supported our work over the years and honor the reporters who go out into the field working to bring about a more just and equitable society. We'll publish our final program on April 28th. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.
Rex Tillerson may have been the president and CEO of ExxonMobil prior to becoming the U.S. Secretary of State, but it didn't help the oil giant in their quest to drill for oil in Russia. Earlier today, the United States Treasury Department refused Exxon's request for a waiver to drill in areas of Russia that are currently under U.S. sanction. The sanctions were imposed in response to Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea and its ongoing support for separatists in eastern Ukraine. The refusal comes at a time when Trump describes the U.S.-Russia relationship as being at, quote, an all-time low, end quote. Although those that remember the Cuban Missile Crisis might disagree with that assessment. Republicans and Democrats alike were opposed to the request. Upon hearing of Exxon's request, Arizona Republican John McCain, an ardent foe of Russia, tweeted, quote, "Are they crazy?" end quote. In an SEC filing, Exxon stated that losses from the blocked joint venture totaled $1 billion through year-end 2015. In their application for a waiver, they expressed concerns that European competitors will gain an advantage in Black Sea drilling.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. If you would like to be a part of the KBOO News crew, call or stop by the station. We'd love to have you on the team. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Jasmine. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, more Talk Radio's Cecil and Celeste talk to students who have just been awarded the 2017 Greenfield Peace Writing Scholarship. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour goes where corporate media fears to tread. At 10, Chris Andre